The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism. So today we'll continue our investigation into our ancestor Shito's wonderful text, The Harmony of Relative and Absolute. And I've been sitting with this, of course, as you all have for the past day or so, actually sitting with it for many years. One of the things that I really appreciate about this text is how it weaves back and forth between an appreciation of the absolute and appreciation of the relative, and shows us again and again and again how these two things are intertwined, in fact, how they are the same thing. In the teachings of Zen, we sometimes aim for the absolute. We talk about thusness and emptiness, and we just did the Heart Sutra earlier. We chanted that, and that's all about how nothing actually exists. All of the teachings of Buddhism are negated in that text. And yet, on the other hand, there is the relative. There is the things of the world, as we say, the 10,000 things that come forward to meet the self, as Dogen says in his Genjo Koan. The way of everyday life is one of the translations of Genjo Koan. So this intertwining of everyday life and nothingness, emptiness, thusness, the absolute, these are the two sides of perception. Yesterday, David talked about three different ways of perceiving things, but I just want to rest back into the two. The two which in this text at one point, Shito says, not one, not two. It's like the foot behind and the foot in front in walking. So this not one, not two, both, neither, and, it can make the mind a little bit dizzy trying to figure this out. And in doing a little bit of investigation into Shito himself, who may have been a legendary figure, someone who was a couple of generations after the sixth ancestor, Wei Nung, and about four generations, I think, before Dongshan, who was one of the founders of the Soto school. He is a pivotal character in clarifying again and again this refined quality of absolute and relative intertwined. He talks about it all the time. All of his various teachings point to this, that you can't have the absolute without relative. You can't have emptiness without form, as the Heart Sutra says, and you can't have form without emptiness. So a couple of the lines in the text that really inspired me today are, the four elements return to their nature as a child to its mother. Fire is hot. Wind moves. Water is wet. Earth hard. Eyes see, ears hear, nose smells, tongue tastes the salt and sour. Each is independent of the other. And what he's describing here is the realm of the senses, the realm of forms, of the 10,000 things arising and falling away, independent of each other, but also infused with the great brightness. In fact, the absolute is sometimes referred to as the great darkness, and he does refer to that a few times in this text. And the world of the relative is the great brightness, because in the brightness, forms can be distinguished one from the other, but in the darkness, all things are one. So one of the teachings that I mentioned, I think, yesterday at some point, maybe in the Dharma dialogue, that was very important to Shito is that let me get the wording. What meets the eye is the way. What meets the eye is the way. We might say what meets the nose is the way, what meets the ears. And of course, even thinking is considered one of the senses in Buddhist psychology, so that there are really six senses rather than five. But this world of form, this is the world that many of us who were so well educated and well trained to think our way into understanding things, this is one of the ways that we can get caught. We hear this beautiful chant to the intertwined quality of form and the absolute, and we try to figure it out. But really, the instruction that Shito, all his life, from what we can gather, the little bits and pieces we know about him, was to point people again and again to the actual lived reality of their lives. What meets the eye is the way. What we encounter, what we experience. This is how we can discover the absolute, not by sitting around and thinking about it. So there's a nice little dialogue in Andy Ferguson's book, Zen's Chinese Heritage, between one of his students and Shito, who comes to him having just visited the great teacher Matsu, who was a contemporary of Shito's, and his lineage traces through the Rinzai school. But Rinzai, of course, Linji hadn't come along yet, but was coming along soon. And so the master asked a monk who'd just come back from visiting Zen Master Ma, "Where have you come from?" And he said, "I've just come from visiting great Master Ma." Always a good start to these dialogues. And then Shito says, "Well, did you see him or not? Did you see him or not?" Knowing how important actual lived experience is to Shito, we can appreciate this question. It's not just, did you get to see him, but did you really see him? Did you see the person who represents this great wisdom and the absolute quality of life shining through him? Did you see great teacher Ma or not? And the monk says, "I saw him," probably responding to the ordinary quality of that question. And then Shito pointed to a pile of firewood and asked, "Was he like this?" The monk didn't answer. He then went back to visit Matsu again, and he told him about the encounter he'd had with Shito. And Matsu said, "Well, how big was that stack of wood?" And the monk said, "Oh, it was really, really big. It was immeasurably big." And Matsu said, "You're really a strong person." And the monk said, "Why do you say that?" And Matsu said, "You carried an immeasurably big pile of wood all the way here from Shito's place. Doesn't that take a lot of strength?" So a very lovely story, once again, pointing to this same teaching, how we carry things in our minds that are constructed realities. We talk about this so often. We talk about, we think about the things that have happened to us. We hear a piece of gossip. I heard one the other day, and we weave endless deductions from that one little piece of gossip, and then we get carried away into all kinds of emotions and speculations and ruminations and obsessions. We think about what's going to happen in the future. "Oh, I finally figured it out. I know what I'm going to do with my life. I'm going to do this, that, and the other thing." And that catches us. And all the time, right here, standing before us, sitting before us, is the great world that comes to meet us, that offers itself to us. It's kind of an amazing thing. And of course, I believe this is what Shito is pointing to here in these lines. He says, "The four elements are always teaching us. They return to their own nature. That we return to them. They're the basic building blocks of being alive. At Sesshin, it's so important to not, well, I'm not going to say that, to notice how much we spend our time thinking, speculating, creating all kinds of constructed realities for ourselves, when all the time the reality that's present is quite enough. It's quite enough that our knees hurt. There's stuff to preoccupy ourselves for at least 25 minutes with investigating the particular hurt in our knees, the particular way that the sun shines in, the particular way that the cars are going by, the particular way that the sun is shining, that the wind is blowing through the trees, that the cushions and the chairs are meeting us perfectly, holding us up as best they can, which is without any fuss or anything extra. We're the ones who make all the extra. And so we can't stop doing that, because that is how minds work. We can't make ourselves be any different than this. We can see clearly how this mechanism of remembering and ruminating and speculating and planning gets us into trouble, takes us away from the very precious opportunity of being a human being right now, with eyes that see and ears that hear, a nose that smells, a tongue that tastes the salt and sour. It's plenty of stuff to keep us occupied. It's almost impossible to be bored during Zen practice. But of course, we do experience boredom because the mind comes in and speculates about something that is different than the way we would like it to be. And there we go, lost again in the endless round of preferences. In another one of Shito's texts, which we read earlier during our sutra service, the Song of the Grass Roof Hermitage, he talks about this again. This is because it's one of his preoccupations, but not everyone's, probably everyone's preoccupation once you really cut to the core of Zen and stop trying to figure it out. It's simpler than we think it is, always. He says, if you want to know the undying person in the hut in the Grass Roof Hermitage, that is, the one who is neither born nor dies, the one who is eternally present in this very moment where space and time and everything else that is speculation drops away. He says, don't separate from this skin bag here and now. And I think many of you know that a skin bag is a way of talking about this human being, a bag of skin that sometimes in some forms of traditional Buddhism and in some forms of other kinds of philosophies, the body is problematic and we need to discard it or see how disgusting it is. In Zen, however, the skin bag is a precious thing. And if we try to separate from it, we lose our connection to this great world where the absolute and the relative interpenetrate each other so that we can't tell one from the other. The darkness of the absolute, the light of the particular, all of these coming to be and fading away, coming into awareness and leaving awareness, not one, not the other, everything all together. When we begin our Zen practice, we begin from the world of form because that's all we've really known. And then we discover that there is something else, something bigger or something that is constantly present in the world that we can't come up with a name for, but we have endless names for this quality of thusness, of emptiness, of the absolute. It's called, I believe, Ri in Japanese. There's no way to point to anything because I think darkness is one of the great ways of understanding it. The great mystery, it's sometimes called, vastness. This is our heart opens to this, our whole bodies open to this through the practice of sitting still and letting the world wash over us without meddling with it, without having to do anything with it, without getting in its way. Then it illuminates us. And then in the light, we see that everything is as it is and also is everything all at the same time. Some of you know the famous story. I think it was a philosopher named Samuel Johnson, who was talking with his biographer, Boswell, about some philosopher who had decided that things didn't exist. He was what a Zen person might call an emptiness junkie, somebody who had found some comfort in the dropping away of mind and body and time and space and had stayed stuck there. We sometimes call this the Zen sickness. So even a few hundred years ago in the West, in Europe, this was something that people thought about. It's not particular to Zen. It's not owned by Zen. It's something that any human being who sits long enough with themselves, with the mind, with the heart, with the senses will discover. And this philosopher, I have his name here, Bishop Berkeley, he had proved the non-existence of matter, and Boswell was saying to Johnson, there's no way to refute him, because what can you do when somebody says everything is empty, nothing exists, how can you refute that? And Johnson famously kicked a stone with his foot and said, I refute him thus. Very much in the spirit of Shito and Zen Master Ma, Matsu saying, did you bring that big pile of firewood all the way with you here? Are you still carrying? You all know that probably that story of the two monks who come to the riverbank and there's a woman there who needs their help. And one of the monks just lifts her up and carries her across. And the other monk is just in completely angry and upset about this violation of the precepts and can't stop talking about it. And he says, how could you pick her up? How could you do that? How could you violate the precepts? We're not supposed to touch women. And the first monk says, well, I put her down on the side of the riverbank, but it seems like you're still carrying her. The mind is so powerful. The mind can create all kinds of things. And how wonderful that that is so, because without the mind, we wouldn't actually be able to make any plans at all. It would just be one thing after the other. And maybe that wouldn't be so bad, but it would be hard to live in the world that human beings have constructed together, this world. My first teacher used to call consensual reality, a reality we've all consensed to. Money is just a consensed reality. All kinds of things are like this. Ideas, that some of which have taken form, not always for the best. Just taking a look at the mess we've gotten ourselves into through our wonderful creativity. So this quality of being able to think is not a problem unless we mistake the thinking for the actuality of life itself. That's the only problem with it. And so we don't suggest that any of us stop thinking during a sesshin, but just that we see when thinking is happening and when we are favoring it over the other five senses. All of the six senses are equally valuable in demonstrating the particularity of things when the great light shines on them. But if we favor one over all the others, we're always missing something. Just like in the three views that David talked about yesterday, the three minds. If we only have one, the other two are diminished somehow, and we are not completely present to the possibilities of what it means to be a full human being. So this is what is the promise of this practice, don't turn away. Don't turn into some mind state that will protect you from the actual world. Maybe you need to do that every now and then because the actual world just gets so oppressive and overwhelming, and that's fine. There are lots of skillful means that we have for retreating from the world. But instead, we say, take the backward step, not as a retreat, but to really see what the nature of reality is, the nature of the self, of the heart, mind, of the world that is full of so much variety. This is the instruction. When we say don't turn away, that's what we mean. As much as you can, facing into your life as it is, experiencing even the most painful things as best you can, with that clarity that most of what causes my suffering is my opinion about it. Stuff happens and it's very sad and it's terrible, but we don't need to keep it going in this endless hamster wheel of the mind. We can breathe in and breathe out. We can face the world and then face away temporarily and then turn back. Not getting stuck anywhere. We learn how to live fully. So Shito says, the four elements return to their nature as a child to its mother. Fire is hot. Wind moves. Water is wet. Earth hard. Eyes see. Ears hear. Nose smells. Tongue tastes the salt and sour. Each is independent of the other. Thank you. So please make yourselves comfortable and we'll have our Dharma dialogue. And please raise your hand if you have a question or a comment or some experience that reflects what the Dharma talk was just pointing to. So we'll start with Michael.
Thank you very much for your talk, Melissa. As you were talking about this discerning mind that spins, it occurred to me that, this analogy of it being sort of like a tool that you use, but you can't put down sometimes. I'm around the temple gardens last week. I had a saw.
Uh-oh. Do I want to hear this?
Cutting some limbs and trees, and I just found myself like, all right, what else can I cut down? And then all of a sudden I step back and say, oh, maybe I shouldn't have cut that one down.
Oh, I just love that analogy. That's right. It's almost like the tool is crazy glued itself to your hand. And so, you know, if you have a saw, then it cuts things down. If you're really, really anxious, then you I had a boyfriend back in the day who used to talk about some people have an anxiety quotient. And if the anxiety starts to go down, what else could I be anxious about? You try to find something. He was actually talking about me, but, but this is, you know, so true, right? And they're tools. Being anxious is actually a really great tool. If we didn't have that, our ancestors wouldn't have survived. It's really good to be afraid of certain things. I love the, in Spanish, the word for worry is preocuparse, which means to preoccupy yourself. I think that's very accurate. We preoccupy ourselves. We use the tools. We don't want to let go of the tools. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks.
Wonderful. Will.
Yeah. There we go. Thank you for a wonderful talk, Melissa. I guess my question is, is about not knowing and kind of letting, you know, this process of focusing on the sensorium and realizing that thoughts are just, you know, moving by and so on. One thing that seems to me to begin to happen is that as I think, or also just personalizing it, trying to think, no, actually, it's really my experience that is being talked about, right? It's just something that tries to realize hearing Zen teachings. But when I do that, when I begin to think that way or feel that way, whatever it is, I quickly become aware that this is not communicable. I'm not going to be able to give a narrative account of what this is, of what it means. And of course, that runs through all the Buddhist teachings, right? No duh, it's, you know, it's something you can't say. But I experience that as with a great fear, or something comes up that, you know, something becomes, if the most important thing is completely private, right? I feel very alone. And I think sometimes then, well, you know, when I die, nobody's coming with me. That is, in fact, the human experience, is to be fundamentally alone. But, you know, talking to myself about, okay, so just die, is also not very cheerful somehow. So I guess I'm just wondering about that fear. I mean, in the Sekito is talking about this, you know, meshing, that the relative doesn't really go away, but sometimes it seems to, and sometimes it seems like in order to kind of remember that there is an absolute, so to speak, one has to kind of interrogate, like, I, you know, think, okay, what are the sort of anchors? Well, I'm a person of such and such an age, and I have this important relationship and this important and this job. And if I let all of that go, will I ever find my way back, or won't it matter? You know? Mm-hmm. So I don't know. It's a lot of questions rolled into one. You know?
Yeah. Wonderful. And just to clarify, just for everybody else, Sekito is the Japanese version of Shito. So that you were referring to. The weird thing about my experience of Zen, which I actually connect with other mystics from other traditions in this place. So not knowing, the great cloud of unknowing, all these different ways we have, the darkness, which is what Shito talks about a lot, the great darkness, and lots of mystics talk about this, the dark night of the soul. So there's a quality when I experience it, and I'm with another person who has also experienced it, we actually know each other. Mm-hmm. This is one of the primary opportunities that happens in Dokusan. Mm-hmm. There's no vocabulary for it. There are no words for it. But the sutras and the koans give us that vocabulary, so we get to talk to each other. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, you know, there's a poem by Rumi, a mystic from Islam, who talks about when the same understanding opens a door between you and another, then you're called to be companions. Mm. So there, it's absolutely true that we are born alone and we die alone. That's right. And yet that's also a story, because, you know, there's some way as this practice unfolds itself that we begin to see that the boundaries of the self are not what we thought they were. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, when somebody asked Jiaozhou, what is Buddha, I think, or why did Bodhidharma come from the West? He said, the cypress tree in the garden. Mm-hmm. And it's like, what? It's like one of these Zen stories here. And said, those people are crazy. I don't understand anything they're saying. What is it? But it was a direct response, because I'm just looking right now at a pear tree out the window. And there's a way that I can say pear tree, or I see the pear tree. But then there's another way of just What's the difference? Where's the me? Where's the pear tree? You know, and it's moving in the wind, so I would move too. There's this is the it's a taste of something that you can't make happen. It's one of the problems, and you can't figure it out and think about it. And we've all been trained to rely on our intellect to help us through. Especially the more educated we are, the better trained we are to avoid this area where the darkness is the teacher, not thinking, not speculation, not logic. So, you know, this is why we emphasize practice. So everything you said is completely true, and everything I said is also true. And there's some intersection where they overlap. Here it is, here it is, here it is.
And Will, I think too, well, one, thank you for articulating that, because you know, we are investigating this together, and we all do our best, and we are investigating the same thing, oddly enough, as separate as we are, you know, can never fully know another human being or what their experience is, and so important to honor that. Quite an arrogance to think we know someone else's life or karma. But yet, as we sit here doing our zazen, what we are experiencing is not just personal. This is not just about your neuroses or my neuroses and finding a way through. This is about life. And one of the through lines of Zen practice through all of the centuries is the zazen posture. Mm-hmm. You know, there are all these teachings and stories and everything, but if you look at drawings of people in medieval China, they are sitting upright, oftentimes with eyes lowered. And I was realizing the other day that we're not practicing to get grounded, right? But we use the body and the breath as something that is beyond thinking, right? The suchness of the body that does its miraculous thing without our intervention. But we use the body and the breath in the middle of this darkness where it's hard to tell what's up and down, what's forward and what's back. All kinds of feelings come and go. Fear, loneliness, joy, ease, spaciousness, contraction. And we're learning to make our home right where we are, to stop running away long enough that our life can offer itself to us.
Yeah. So I'm glad you said that so clearly, that I pointed at that in the talk and meant to say more, but don't separate from the skin bag here and now. That's the teaching. Mm-hmm. You know, that's it right there. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks, Will.
Let's see, Jenny.
Thanks, Melissa. I really like the idea that thinking is another sense. Most of the time it seems like I'm walking through the environment, receiving these sensations, and that makes the thoughts happen inside me, and they're my thoughts. But once in a while, it's clear you and I are walking through the environment together, and we receive the thoughts from the environment.
Yes. Yes. Isn't that cool?
And then the thoughts are kind of, you know, because of my history and because of your history, and that's part of the environment. Mm-hmm. That's the part of the environment I'm carrying around.
Well, and it's the wonderful Tollefson reading we have of who owns the weather. This idea that clouds come in, and you know, what if thoughts just are the weather of the moment, that we're, and our brain receives that weather.
And then, oh yeah, this is what it is. This thought.
That's a load on.
Yeah, yeah, it is.
It is. You know, and it's related to what Michael said about the tool. Thinking is a tool, use it as a tool. But if it's the only one you have, then you'll just keep, you know, but if you just receive it like birdsong, thought, you know, smell of the flowers, emotion, just blah, 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 one thing after the other. Yeah, you could keep your hand. This is why that book is called Opening the Hand of Thought. I think it's because you put the tool down, the tool leaves. It comes and it goes. And who's doing that? But we can do something of making a construction of it.
Well, and in that way, we don't have to take our thoughts personally. We don't have to take our Zen practice personally. Our first teacher used to always say at the beginning of retreat, don't take anything that happens here personally. But some relief to be engaged in some unfolding that is beyond us, and we do our part and we watch it all come and go. So thanks,
Jen.
Thank
you. Alan.
Yeah, so I wanted to share my little bit of my reaction to your talking about the skin bag. And I appreciate the way that you pointed out that Shito and Zen kind of rescued that from this term that I was originally supposed to be pretty gross. You know, and the first time you hear it, I think it's like, ugh, a skin bag. And yet, you know, you're pointing out that this is how we are awakened through our body in Zen as well as our mind. And I just wanted to share that some years ago, I read a wonderful book called Descartes' Error by Antonio Damasio that really enhanced the ways I thought about the body and especially the skin. And he points out that the skin is not just our largest sensory organ, but our largest internal organ. And it's in constant communication with both the inside of the body and, of course, you know, with the what we think of as the external world. And so the skin as this wonderfully porous, you know, membrane that not that you were talking about the boundaries of the self. It's not what separates us from the world. It's what joins the inside world to the outside world. And yeah. I'm thinking of it kind of like a saloon door, you know, that swings open both ways constantly.
Yeah. Or that it's hard to imagine this, but that it's open and boundaried at the same time, exactly the same time. When I love you pointing to, you know, this kind of natural human tendency to be a bit disgusted by the body and how that's been taken up by various world religions, including original Buddhism, as a you know, let's transcend, guys. Why be in the body? This is a real problem. I don't like it. It ages. It gets sick. And then I was thinking of this during the Five Remembrance today. So it ages. It gets sick. It's a bag of skin. This is the way it is. We have a very dear friend who's one of his main teachings. He's a scholar, well, a Buddhist teacher. In a Southeast Asian tradition, and he teaches something called the 32 parts of the body. And it's like a scanning through the body, but with the element of yuck, you know, like mucus and blood and piss and shit. And, you know, in Zen, we say mucus, blood, piss, shit. If you're still doing the, then you investigate the, like it doesn't matter. Right. So if disgust is present, we embrace disgust. If appreciation is present, we appreciate appreciation.
Yeah.
Dried shit stick. I see.
Dried shit stick. That's right. Exactly. Yeah. So anybody else? All right. Well, let's come back to our sitting posture for a few moments.